Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An opioid overdose can occur anywhere, in a restaurant, a movie theater, along the side of a road, and they are occurring with increased frequency. Columbus Fire reports that for medics administering naloxone for overdoses, nearly 4 in 10 since January occurred in public places. Columbus City and Franklin County Health, Fire, and Law Enforcement agencies have responded by expanding the response training to law enforcement. And the public. Joining us is Lieutenant Matthew Parrish with the Columbus Division of Fire. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, set the scene for us. What are you experiencing out there on a day-to-day basis with regards to overdoses and the use of a naloxone?
So our paramedics just in the city of Columbus, we're seeing 8 to 10 overdoses that require Narcan or naloxone to reverse the overdose.
A week or a day? Or?
Per day. And again, that's just in the city of Columbus. That doesn't cover the what the surrounding townships or other cities are seeing, in the greater Columbus area. And most of the time, it's taking even more than one dose to reverse the overdose of the opiate. We're seeing them everywhere. We're seeing them in parking lots, bathrooms at a fast food restaurant, a grocery store. A lot of times they're in homes as well. The majority of them are occurring, where folks are alone or isolated. But that's what we're seeing on a daily basis.
But increasingly on a public scale, in the public too.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you get a call for an overdose, what tells you that don't forget to bring the naloxone or the Narcan out? Is there something specific?
So the calls are triaged by the alarm office, and a lot of times they'll come in as an overdose based on the information they gathered prior to us being sent. But a lot of times we'll get sent on just a difficulty breathing or an ill person. So there are telltale signs of an opiate overdose. One is just slow to respond or sluggish, maybe a little altered mental status, or shortness of breath or slow, really slow, shallow respirations. And one of the telltale signs is pinpoint pupils that don't react to the change in light.
And when we talk about an overdose, is that something that – what do we mean by that? It used to mean that someone died. They overdosed.
Well, the way the opiate drug affects the body is it really depresses the respiratory system. So that when folks take too much of an opiate, whether it's prescribed or it's an illegal drug like heroin, it starts to slow their breathing down to the point where if it stops, then they could go into cardiac arrest. So the overdose is, it's occurring. We're seeing all different forms of it, whether it's heroin, whether it's pain pills, people just using too much of their pain medicine, or people that are using it incorrectly. Some of those drugs are slow release and they're crushing them and they'll snort them, and so they get all the drug at once. The most vulnerable population for an overdose are folks that are in recovery, and then they relapse and they use at the normal volume that they had used prior, and it's just too much, and it sends them into respiratory depression and then cardiac arrest.
We're talking about the official response to overdose incidents of opioid overdose in the city of Columbus. My guest is Lieutenant Matthew Parrish. He's with the Columbus Division of Fire. The Columbus Public Health is holding a free training on how to administer naloxone. It's next Tuesday. For more information about that, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Lieutenant Parrish, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. The Columbus Dispatch has reported that many overdoses are occurring in public now, as we just talked about. And some say that it's so that people can find them faster. They want to be in public so that in case they do overdose, someone finds them. What do you know about why people were finding them in bathrooms at gas stations and that kind of a thing?
So I'm not sure if it's the person that's using is doing it in public so they can be found. My understanding is that the addiction is so strong that by the time they meet their supplier or pick up their drug, that they can't wait to use it. So if they're in a parking lot at a mall and they meet the dealer, they take it. The minute they get back in their car, they're using the drug. Or they meet them at a fast food restaurant. You know, a lot of these transactions occur in public in just the blink of an eye. And before, it's not like they're going to take it and drive back home and then wait and use it. So that's why I think a lot of them are occurring in public. And again, it's what we really have seen just through our reports is a lot of these folks are just recently, they may just have been released from rehab or detox, and they go straight to their old routine. Mm-hmm. They meet somebody, they go right into the bathroom, shoot up, and then they overdose.
Does everybody now in the Division of Fire have, they're all armed or whatever with naloxone or Narcan, right?
Yeah, all of our first responders, our paramedic crews and our ALS engines, we carry the naloxone or Narcan on the vehicles. A lot of our supervisors are even carrying it, and a lot of our members are carrying it personally just because, like you said, this is happening everywhere in the city and the suburbs. So no matter where we live, people know we're firefighters. And if something happens, they're going to show up. And it would be sad not to have a drug that could save somebody's life right there ready to go.
How do you administer naloxone?
So it can be administered intranasally through an atomizer spray called a MAD device. It's very simple to use. It doesn't require much more than a 5-minute training as far as how to dispense it. It's a syringe. It has a tip that fits in the nostril, and you dispense half of it in each nostril, and it atomizes it into a spray similar to like an Afrin spray or something you'd have if you had a sinus infection. Everybody's probably used one of those.
If you administer it and the person wasn't overdosing, does it hurt them?
No. So the Narcan has no negative side effect. The one thing you do have to be careful is a lot of times after you administer it, the patient can vomit. Mm-hmm. So what we recommend is after you administer it, you roll them on their side and put them what we call the recovery position. And if after you administered it, they are not responding, you need to start CPR immediately.
And when you talk about a dose of it, is it a self? Is it already measured out?
It's a pre-filled syringe. Okay. It has 2 milliliters of fluid and 2 milligrams of the drug. That's what we carry in Columbus. There are some over-the-counter Narcan that carry 4 milligrams of the drug, but are also in the 2 milliliter, and it's administered the same way. The Narcan can be picked up. It's recently, the laws were changed to allow you to purchase it without a prescription, mm-hmm. and almost every pharmacy is carrying it. Through some of the public health agencies, there's some free supplies that can be picked up, but it's readily available. So if you have a family member that is dealing with opiate addiction, it's imperative that you have that available.
Ryan in Marysville, you're on the air with Lieutenant Matthew Parrish from the Columbus Division of Fire. Hi, Ryan.
Howdy. I have a quick question. I took one of the classes through the Union County Health Department to administer the drug. Mm-hmm. And it was a great class. I highly recommend everybody to do it. Very educational and all that. I have a question, though. We were informed about the drug, the limitations of temperature that it can be in, and it wants to be in a certain temperature, else it can expire and stuff like that. And I was wondering how you guys have gone about to remedy that. If there's, like, do you keep it in the glove box that's cool or whatever
Yeah.
So in the fire department, it's relatively easy for us to do that. It remains on our vehicle. which is temperature control when we're out in the environment. We either have the heater on or the air conditioner to kind of keep it in that safe range. And then when we park the vehicle back in the station, it's temperature controlled. But yes, it is acceptable or receptive to being damaged if it's in extreme heat or extreme cold.
Okay, so then take it out of the car. Don't leave it in the heat.
Yeah, I personally carry mine in my backpack that goes in and out of the house with me every day.
Okay.
So I don't leave it in the vehicle.
Okay, Ryan, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. Daniel in Columbus, you're a school teacher. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thank you. I just had two questions kind of about demographics. First, you said 10 cases in Columbus, and then that doesn't include the surrounding areas.
A day,
I was wondering if you were thinking maybe more in the surrounding areas or if we had any data on that. And then my second question is, what kind of people are you seeing overdosing? As a school teacher, is this something that I should be concerned about in middle schools and high schools?
Well, first of all, the data from the surrounding townships and the other city fire departments, I don't have access to that. But just from speaking with my colleagues, I know that they are seeing a increased rate of overdoses. I would almost suspect, and again, this isn't data-based, but I would suspect that they probably combined see as many or very close to what we're seeing daily. So that number could almost be doubled in the greater Columbus area. As far as the age demographic, about 50% of our patients in Columbus are between 26 and 45. And we see very few minors under the age of 17. But with that being said, I wouldn't, as a school teacher, and with that, you obviously have a vulnerable population when they are starting to explore.
They're getting started with it at that age,
yeah.
Perhaps.
And there has been cases where drugs such as marijuana have been laced with heroin or with fentanyl or some other opiate based. So a kid that just thinks, hey, I'm just smoking pot or something like that, they could be getting something else and actually have a very bad reaction to it. So, and again, like Ann mentioned, the Narcan has no, it won't hurt you if you gave it to somebody and it was just another drug.
Okay. Daniel, thanks a lot for that call. The Columbus Division of Fire has teamed up with the Alcohol and Drug Addiction Mental Health Services and Southeast Healthcare to form the Rapid Response Emergency Addiction and Crisis Team. What is that program? What are you doing there?
So we call it the REACT Team, mm-hmm. and it is our emergency response to the overdose patient while they're still at the ER. And again, it's a partnership with Adam H. Southeast and Columbus Fire, and it's a two-year pilot project that we started working on at the beginning of the year, and we finally rolled it out in May. And it teams up a mental health nurse, a social worker, and a paramedic. They respond to the hospital after the overdose occurs, and they engage the patient right at that point. What we were finding was a lot of times the individuals that overdose, they will elope from the ER or leave the ER before they have a chance to speak with the social workers there or be informed of some of the options. So our team tries to connect that patient with the most appropriate resource for dealing with their addiction or even other mental or other medical conditions. A lot of these folks, there's a reason why they were using opiates, whether it was, an injury, back pain, dental problems. And again, using the drugs and sometimes the dirty needles cause other medical problems like, hepatitis or HIV, and those patients aren't being treated for those items. So we try to link them and get them either to rehab, to detox, or just basic primary care. And all that's done through the engagement of the social worker and the nurse on the team to direct them if they're willing. I mean, we've been in service now for about a month, and we've had 113 requests that occurred during our hours of operation. We're rolling this team out pretty slow as far as we were 8 hours Monday through Friday. Out of those 113 requests, we were able to make 100 patient contacts, and we had 18 patients that we were unable to assess. They either left the ER or they were too medically unstable to speak with. Hmm. We had 33 that refused our service completely. And again, it's about meeting them where they are in their addiction. Some people, they're just not ready to consider recovery. We've scheduled 51 follow-up appointments with our primary care team at Southeast. Five patients were taken directly to detox or rehab from the ER, and six of those patients were actually transported from the ER to an appointment with Southeast.
Once again, the Columbus Public Health is holding free training on how to administer naloxone next Tuesday. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Lieutenant Matthew Parrish, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
It's Lieutenant Matthew Parrish. He's with the Columbus Division of Fire. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You probably have never heard of Fred Kumerow, the researcher who spent nearly 60 years warning about the dangers of trans fats in food. He was the first to connect them with heart disease, strokes, and cardiac arrest. He died recently at the age of 102, but not before his work was vindicated by the Food and Drug Administration, which has banned trans fats beginning in 2018. New York Times food reporter Kim Severson is credited for bringing Kumerow's warnings to a wider audience in her 2006 book, The Trans Fat Solution, Cooking and Shopping to Eliminate the Deadliest Fat from Your Diet. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Hi.
Also joining us is David Schleifer. He's a healthcare sociologist and research director at Public Agenda, a nonpartisan nonprofit in New York City. He helped implement New York City's trans fat ban. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kim Severson, how long have trans fats been with us?
Well, you know, anybody who remembers Crisco back in the day, actually 20s and 30s when it became really common in American kitchens, we've had trans fat for a long time. The problem is it started to get into processed foods once we started to get cake mixes and packaged cookies and those kinds of things at the grocery store. That any baked good that had, you know, if you think about the inside of an Oreo, that was the perfect vehicle for trans fats. And it got into our food supply as we started buying more processed and packaged foods. So really, 70s, you know, late 60s, 70s, and 80s is when we really started eating a lot of it, when we got away from home cooking and more into processed foods.
So, why processed foods? What about trans fats?
Well, it's a great thing. It keeps things stable. It's food manufacturers can use it. It's an artificial fat, so and it doesn't melt at room temperature. And so, unlike butter or lard, or well, lard gets hard at room temperature, but unlike other fats, it's inexpensive. You can manipulate it really easily in the food processing system, and it just never melts. And so you can do a whole lot with it. And like I say, it's inexpensive. It's a manufactured fat. So it was really like the greatest thing for food processors, because they can make bread stay shelf stable longer. Like I say, those Oreo cookies, you wouldn't have that Oreo cream without it. It has a lot of uses.
So is it that the very thing that makes it useful in processed foods, the thing that hurts it in hurts us in humans?
Well, your other guest is probably able to describe what it does in your body a lot more easily than I can, because I think there's a lot of chemical reactions that happen with it.
David Schleifer?
Sure. So, you know, what sort of the kind of the scientific consensus that developed around trans fats is that, and starting in the early 90s, is that it both raises bad cholesterol and also lowers good cholesterol. And, you know, that's typically when people talk about saturated fats, they talk about, you know, the concern that saturated fats raises bad cholesterol. And some saturated fats actually raise good cholesterol as well, but trans fat, sort of a double whammy in that it both raises the bad stuff and lowers the good stuff.
We talked about the researcher who spent 60 years working on this. Kim Severson, when did it occur to you that this was an issue enough so that you wrote an entire book about it?
Well, I was working at the San Francisco Chronicle back in the late 90s and early 2000s, and I talked to some researchers at the University of California at San Francisco and some other folks who kept saying, you know, the stuff that's really bad is this thing called trans fat, which, of course, I'm like, what? And I had to figure out fat science and understand kind of what trans fat was. But the Food and Drug Administration had been concerned about it since 1994, and they started looking at whether food labels should contain trans fat. You know, because we were all in that, you remember everybody was like, oh, is it saturated fat or is it mono? And we were all looking at food labels and people were getting educated about fat. This was, you know, in 1999, the Surgeon General declared childhood obesity an epidemic. So if you think about when we were really looking at health and fats and obesity is a public health problem, that was happening right there in the late 90s. And trans fat had been on the Food and Drug Administration's radar since the 90s. And in fact, they talked about trying to put trans fat on food labels since 1994. And so if you look at it now, here we are 23 years later, they're actually finally, dealing with completely eliminating trans fat. I mean, it's taken a long time. But what's so interesting is I started thinking about this and writing about it, and I think in about 2002, the National Academy of Science released a study that was part of this long process to get trans fat listed that talked about, they said that the National Academy of Science said that this was the most dangerous fat in the food supply and recommended that people eat as little of it as possible. And they said there was no safe level to be that you could eat. And so that I think shook things up enough where the writing was on the wall that trans fats that the amount of trans fat needed to at least be on food labels. And this was so interesting, and from a public health perspective, because I think it was one of the first times that the threat of telling the public that trans fat was in your food forced manufacturers to start getting it out of their food. So it wasn't that the government said, food manufacturers, you can't put this in your food. It was they said, we're going to start requiring you to label food that has this in it. And that's when food manufacturers did this 180-degree turn on trans fat and started reformulating. There's like a trans fat-free Crisco, and they started, you know, all the labels were like trans fat-free. I mean, you would get, you know, Twizzlers had trans fat-free, even though they never had it to begin with, but had had it on the label.
It was a selling point.
It was such a selling point. So it was a really fascinating moment in terms of using information on labels to change consumer behavior. So. But again, look at how long this has taken.
Yeah.
You know, that study came out in 1994. So,
yeah. David Schleifer, it's one thing to say, don't eat this, it could be bad for you. It's another thing to ban it. You worked to implement New York City's trans fat ban. Tell us when that started and what it took.
Sure. And I should say my role was really I was kind of hired to help the city's trans fat help center as they were trying to understand how the ban was going to play out for restaurants in the city. And,
okay.
And so I had the nice task of going out and talking to people in some bakeries and other sort of industrial, you know, food production facilities in the city to understand the kind of challenges that they were facing as they tried to replace what Kim said is an extremely versatile and useful fat that was really in a lot of recipes that you know, industrial bakeries were using. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting about what New York City did is that a lot of other cities, you know, after New York City decided to ban trans fats from restaurants, and of course, you know, cities regulate restaurants and the FDA regulates packaged food, so it's really up to cities to address what's happening in restaurants. After the city made that decision, they really invested a lot of money in creating this, what they called the Trans Fat Help Center, which was designed as a sort of an information resource to provide technical assistance to restaurants and bakeries in the city so that they could help, you know, to help them figure out how they were going to replace trans fats, replace the oils that contain trans fats. Because, you know, this kind of scale of industrial food manufacturing and baking is, you know, it's complicated, and you know, restaurants, they want to use something that works. So the city really did a lot of work to help make that transition easier for restaurants in the city. And other cities that followed suit that implemented the ban, like Philadelphia, they moved very quickly and didn't provide that kind of technical assistance, and they got a lot of pushback from restaurants in the city. So I think, you know, New York really took its time with it and really thought through what it was going to mean for restaurants to replace this fat in their recipes.
Kim Severson, what is an FDA ban, the one that's supposed to take effect in 2018? Is that for all restaurants, or is that all foods, or what are we talking about there?
Well, that's for basically getting it out of the food supply. So, you know, it's not like restaurants go and buy vats of trans fat. What they buy are processed chicken nuggets or, you know, baked goods. Or, I mean, they may use some kinds of shortenings in their baked goods, and there are certainly good alternative trans fat-free shortenings. But mostly they're talking about what the FDA ban will be on processed foods. And I think there's some... I haven't read it as completely as I should, but I think there's a few exceptions for very small businesses. There were some family bakeries that felt like they needed to. I think there's a small amount of like shortening at family bakeries that can be used. But overall, we're talking about eliminating it from food manufacturing. And, you know, the amount of food we eat that's processed, which is, you know, basically just means that somebody took raw ingredients and did something to it and put it in a package to sell it. You know, garbanzo beans in a can, you could consider processed food. So, but the processed food industry is huge. And so it essentially means that you can't use this in food manufacturing in the way that they eliminated. I don't know if you recall, there was a red dye that had been linked to as a carcinogen, and that became the FDA banned that. Saccharin they banned there. So there are these things that come along every once in a while that are just considered so bad, the government decides we're not going to be allowed to feed it to people. Makes sense to me, but, you know, I'm not a bureaucrat.
David Schleifer, is anybody studying the impact on, the, you know, a health-related impact in New York City since the ban?
There have been a few studies that have used, you know, big epidemiological data sets that have shown health benefits. You know, I think not necessarily New York City based, but there have been a few other studies. I think even national studies that have shown, you know, and what I'm not sure is whether they've just shown reductions in cholesterol in people's serum cholesterol in their blood, or whether they're actually showing a reduction in actual heart attacks. But there is research that has really tried to crunch these numbers and show the health benefits of both the city's ban and of the FDA's labeling, trans fat labeling rule, which that took effect in 2006. And really, by the time the FDA, because it took a while for the FDA to develop that labeling rule, pretty much as soon as they started considering labeling, which, as Kim said, was in 1994, food manufacturers and the edible oil manufacturers, they started working right away on those trans fat alternatives. So pretty much by the time that 2006 labeling rule took effect, a lot of big companies had already replaced trans fat. And so there is research that has tracked effects, since those labeling rules took effect.
Kim Severson, your book, the subtitle, Cooking and Shopping to Eliminate the Deadliest Fat from Your Diet, might not be as necessary anymore with the ban going forward in 2018. But as far as cooking goes, did it change your cooking habits? I mean, I use Crisco in my pie crust.
Right.
It's the new kind.
I still use a little Crisco sometimes, too, I have to say. A little half Crisco, half butter, which
yeah,
I think works
exactly.
well. But the Crisco, you'll see, is formulated now. They found a different way to do it that doesn't create those trans fats. So, what's interesting is that this, when I wrote that book, it just didn't occur to people that, the many places in which trans fat existed. Mm-hmm. And it came out at a time when home cooking overall was a little bit on the surge. I mean, if you look where we are now in food culture and how much particularly millennials and other people are cooking and the sort of return to the kitchen mm-hmm. and return to cooking, that's happened over the last decade, right? So at the time when people were trying to think about unhitching from so much processed foods, farmers markets were really exploding during that time in the late 90s and early 2000s. So it occurred there was not only this government pressure about this particular kind of additive. People were getting really interested in what was in their food mm-hmm. and cooking more. And I don't know if you remember, Häagen-Dazs came out with a 5-ingredient, that was their marketing thing. It was only 5 ingredients in their ice cream, which seemed like a revelation at the time, but it's just sugar and butter and sugar and cream and vanilla. So that was the fact that Häagen-Dazs marketed an ice cream with not many ingredients on the label shows where we were at a period of time when trans fat was getting eliminated. So I guess my point is it came at a time when we were all cooking differently and starting to look at food labels and starting to think about what fresher food from a farmer's market might look like. And so we're in a really different place now than we were in 2002 as cooks, I think as home cooks, but moreover as eaters. And, still you're not addressing that, McDonald's French fry level of eating, which, God knows I like an occasional McDonald's mm-hmm. French fry. But I think it's part of a larger move culturally, in a shift that we probably won't understand until we're still another 10 or 20, 30 years down the road, where we've really come to think about what we're putting in our bodies and the effect that food has on how we eat. So we have to kind of look at it as a chapter in this bigger book that is being written right now. And that's certainly what the New York ban was about. In some ways, it certainly was, I think, it was part of this New York City to getting more politically involved in how people eat, the whole nanny state thing. We're seeing it now with taxes on sodas. So we're trying to figure out a way to get people to be healthier via what they eat. And that seems kind of like a no-brainer, but it's really hard to get a culture like us that likes to eat and that eats so much processed food to think a little differently. And listen, trust me, I have some, I've got the Trader Joe's version of Oreos in my cupboard right now, and I occasionally love a good McDonald's French fry. I'm not saying we all need to eat, farro salads and lean turkey breast here.
Kim Severson, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Kim Severson is a national food reporter for the New York Times. Also, David Schleifer, director of research at Public Agenda. David, thanks to you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 10% of the world population is now obese. That's according to a new study published by the New England Journal of Medicine. More than a third of Americans fall into that category. The struggle to lose the pounds differs for everyone, but some of us just don't have the time. Or so we think. Health journalist Robert Davis and personal trainer Bag Kolowich Jr. have written a new book to address that issue. It's entitled Fitter, Faster, The Smart Way to Get in Shape in Just Minutes a Day. Robert Davis, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you.
Also, Brad Kolowich, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Robert, why do so many people find it hard to fit in exercise? What do they say are the biggest barriers?
Well, Ann, you know, there are a number of barriers for many of us. I like to say that there are three D's are the problem: dislike, dread, and drudgery. A lot of us don't like to exercise. That's a big problem. Also, there's an intimidation factor. You know, people go into a gym and see there's equipment that looks like something you'd see in a torture chamber. You see perfectly sculpted bodies. So sometimes just not knowing what to do, that keeps people from exercising. But the biggest one is lack of time. We have busy lives, and people say, you know, I don't have time to fit in the recommended amount of exercise of 30 minutes at least. A day, 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. And so that's a big barrier, and that's something we've tried to address to lower those barriers, particularly the fact that most people don't have enough time, to make exercise more doable and less daunting.
What do we mean by exercise, Brad Kolowich?
To mean by exercise? Well,
yeah.
Exercise can be in a variety of different forms, and you know, whether that be strength training, aerobic training, plyometric training, stretching. You know, in our book, what we've done is we've created a comprehensive plan in Fitter Faster. So we've put together a plan that can be done in as little as 15 minutes in the day. And what it is it's a combination of two different strength training circuits. We also have a variety of cardio days as well, so conventional cardio as well as some plyometric cardio, in addition to a choice exercise day. And then we combine some stretching, some dynamic exercises to warm up your body prior to, then, of course, some static stretching as well. So exercise can be looked at, you know, through a lot of different forms, and we provide all of those forms of exercise in Fitter Faster, making it very comprehensive and something that can be done, and again, as little as 15 minutes out of the day.
And if I may add, mm-hmm. I think one of the problems often is that people think of exercise as things they don't want to do. They think of it as running on a treadmill, or they think of it as doing things that they find unpleasant. And exercise does not have to be that. It's all about finding activities that you enjoy and can continue doing. That's key.
Right.
Yeah, and what about goals? I mean, you talked about people with their ripped bodies in the gym, but is that, should it be? I mean, what should people's goals, how do you define what a goal is in your book, Robert Davis?
I think a goal should be, and that's really varies from person to person. I mean, for me, the most important thing about exercise is it can make you healthier and can enhance the quality of your life. That is, your ability to enjoy your life, to feel better. And we talk about in the book a number of things that exercise can do for you in terms of enhancing the quality of your life and making you healthier and stronger. And to me, that's the most important thing. Now, obviously, for some people, for a lot of people, it's losing weight and looking better. We talk in the book about the way that exercise can play a role, but diet is more important, actually, when it comes to losing weight than exercise. And I think sometimes it's unfortunate that people exercise solely to lose weight, and then they find that it doesn't help them shed the pounds the way they expect, and they give up and say, well, I'm not going to exercise anymore. And that's a big mistake. And so we need to go in to exercise managing our expectations about what it can and cannot do when it comes to weight.
Brad Kolowich, we've heard that 30 minutes a day is optimal. You argue that 15 minutes can be just as effective. So what you would fit into 30 minutes would be different than what you would cram into 15 minutes?
You know, that's a great question. And you know, it's not that there's anything wrong with 30 minutes a day, mm-hmm. or even longer than that. But what we've done is we've created a plan that can be extremely effectively done in 15 minutes. So we've created what's called a circuit. And so rather than doing a particular exercise, for example, and resting, and, you know, maybe carrying on a conversation with a friend or whatnot, mm-hmm. you're moving from one exercise to the next. So we've put eight exercises together, really sandwiched them together. And, you know, the rest periods in between those exercises are really just moving from one exercise to the next. So we've pretty much just maximizing your time in between sets. So we're compacting everything together. And again, before that, doing a dynamic warm-up, so making sure that your muscles are warmed up for that activity. And then following that, a static stretch, so making sure that, you know, once the muscles are warm, that you're cooling them down. So, again, compacting all of that into a short period of time. So really kind of high-intensity interval training, you know, just constantly moving and just ensuring that you're maximizing your time, whether you're downtime in between exercises or not. So again, 15 minutes can be extremely effective.
A lot of times in the class I take three times a week, it's a couple times a week in this particular one, but it's, they call it the 20-30, where you're working out, you know, 20 super high intense seconds, or 30 seconds and 30-10 or something like that, and then it's 10
right.
seconds rest.
Exactly. So they call those the ratios, right? So in the case of a 30-10, that would be 30 seconds of effort followed by 10 seconds of rest. So, you know, a 3-to-1 ratio in that case, and mm-hmm. then, which is very difficult. And then, 2-to-1, great. So that'd be an example as 20 seconds of effort followed by 10 seconds of rest. And then in more of a, you know, something for intermediate, maybe more of a 1-to-1 ratio. So something like a 30 by 30. So 30 seconds of effort by 30 seconds of rest. And then for those just getting started, maybe look into something more like a 1-to-4 ratio. So for example, 30 seconds of effort by, 4 minutes of rest, or 2 minutes rest rather. So, yes, it really kind of all comes down to your fitness level when it comes down to those ratios.
You know, Robert Davis, you mentioned the 3 D's. One of them's dread. And how much does it help to get somebody who motivates you to do this?
That's very important, I mean, for some people. And I think you can have that on several levels. You can hire someone like Brad, who's a fantastic trainer in Atlanta. You can hire, if you have access to a trainer, if that's your thing, to have a professional help you, that can help. But working out with somebody else can be a great way, too, having a buddy. And that's something that a lot of people have found helpful, to have somebody that you can work out with that makes you accountable, so you'll show up. And, you know, on days you don't want to get out of bed or don't want to go, that you should have somebody there that's waiting for you. Or joining a class. That's something else that a lot of people find helpful, to be with other people and have other people to work out with. That can be helpful as well. So I think this issue of working out with other people. Now, again, that's not possible for everybody. And some people like me, for example, just prefer to work out alone. And so that's, you can do that. But then having online tools, having apps, working using their studies that show that people that join communities, online communities, fitness communities, that's helpful too, to provide encouragement. So there are ways to get encouragement even if you work out alone.
Brad Kolowich, I've learned, you know, that over time, that, you know, you have to know thyself. And different people, Robert Davis just said he likes to work out alone, but you must see a lot of different people with a lot of different personalities and lifestyles. That, how do you help them find what works for them?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, everybody's different. It's interesting. You know, I'll work with, those that, you know, in their 50s, really starting exercise in their 50s, that haven't touched a weight in their life. And then on the other hand, you know, working with those that have, you know, competed in the Kona Ironman, and those that have been a professional athlete before. And mm-hmm. so it's kind of interesting to see that, you know, and everybody's different in terms of kind of where they're starting and whatnot. But I'd say it definitely just varies on the individual, but you know, you kind of try to find their motivation and what drives them. And again, everybody's different. You'll have those that, you know, they're driven by their appearance, right? And they just want to simply look good, and that's it, right? And they're willing to do whatever it takes to look great, you know. And then you have those that are like, look, my doctor's suggested that I come in and lose this weight. You know, let's make this happen. And they're driven by the health side. So everybody's a little different.
But of the 6 major benefits, and you've already mentioned this about regular exercise, weight loss isn't one of them.
Right. And we talk about in the book. Now, that's not to say that you can't control your weight with exercise, because studies do show that exercise can be effective when it comes to helping you maintain weight loss. So if
right.
you already lost weight, you're trying to keep it off, there's good evidence that exercise can be regular exercise can be beneficial there. Where it gets tricky is whether actually losing more weight, to what extent exercise can help. Now, that's not to say it can't help at all, or it can't help with fat burning, and we actually talk about ways that to use high-intensity interval training and other types of exercise to enhance fat burning. But it is to say that it takes a lot of exercise and a lot of very intense exercise for you to actually lose weight, and you actually can have more effective and actually quicker results from changing your diet, eating fewer calories when it comes to weight loss. And again, it's something that people need to know so they can go into exercising having realistic expectations.
A healthy diet, a good diet, is really important for me when it comes to exercise. I notice the difference a lot when I do high-intensity training. Do you talk about diet, Brad Kolowich, in the book? Is it something that, as a personal trainer, that you talk about with your clients?
Absolutely. You know, we do touch on that in the book as well. But the biggest thing is, you know, just kind of in a nutshell, just focusing on whole foods, right? So minimizing processed foods, you know, lots and lots of vegetables and healthy fats. And, you know, if you're doing the meats, you know, lean or healthy proteins, not necessarily lean, but healthy protein sources. But, you know, so we do touch on that in the book. But with clients, absolutely, you know, those that are looking to, you know, specifically focus on weight loss, you know, we do focus on, you know, eating the right kinds of food, but then also controlling the amount of calories that they're taking in as well. So we'll get a, you know, take a look, a good look, you know, typically a 3-day snapshot of what they're doing, and then, you know, guide them from there based on what they're currently doing and, you know, whether they're looking to lose weight or gain weight. You know, we have a combination of the two, and we'll, you know, guide in the right direction based on what they're currently doing there. But absolutely, in terms of, you know, weight loss, definitely needing to make those adjustments in terms of nutrition, and then also for you know, long-term health as well.
Robert, you've had a particular journey in fitness. Tell us about what, you know, about the trajectory of your journey. Where did you start and where have you ended up?
Well, I certainly did not start exercising. As a kid, I hated to exercise. I hated to sweat. I was an overweight kid and would do everything I could to get out of having to go to gym class. And so I discovered as I got to college, though, the importance of health. I got interested in health, started reading about it, and realized I needed to incorporate some kind of physical activity. So I started running. That's something I thought I would try. It actually worked for me. It doesn't work for everybody, mm-hmm. but it worked for me, and I started running gradually and increasing my distance and my speed. And then over time, I got interested in other forms of exercise and started going to the gym lifting weights and realized that adding strength training was important because I saw that you can't just do one kind of exercise like aerobics. You need to have a comprehensive approach, which includes strength training and other kinds of exercises. So I started gradually incorporating those. So I like to say that in middle age, I'm in the best shape of my life and far better shape than I was as a kid. And I like to say if I can do it, anybody can do it. So that but the key for me was finding activities I actually enjoy doing and that could keep doing. And that's what everybody needs to do, and that's what I want to help other people do, is to find what works for you, find the activities that work for you so that you can keep doing them.
Brad Kolowich, why can't you just run? Why isn't running enough as far as strength training goes? What's the distinction?
You know, running's wonderful, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with just that. But, you know, what I'd suggest, you know, running being more of a cardiovascular exercise. So it's wonderful for the heart, but you're not necessarily focusing on many of the other muscle groups and putting them to that, putting them through the resistance that they actually need, you know, in terms of strength. So, you know, I suggest a combination of strength, cardio, and then also nutrition. So really putting the main three together. So in Fitter Faster, we'd kind of just break it all down and simplify it for you. So among the 7 days out of the week, we have a rest day in there, of course, but among the other days, we put together you know, two different strength circuits, which I mentioned in terms of 8 exercises. And then we also incorporate the high-intensity interval training, which is wonderful for fat loss, as Robert mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then we bring in the plyometrics as well, which are more of just jumping exercises. So we really show you nicely how to break those down. But, again, extremely important just for, you know, not only sustaining muscle mass, you know, as we age, but also bone density and all that as well, and preventing injury and so on. So strength training is extremely important. Running is great. That's a great start, but really, you know, if you can take that running and incorporate more of strength circuits and strength training as we show in Fitter Faster, I think that's, you know, really ideal. That's the ideal way to put the package together.
Brad Kolowich, Jr., thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Ann, for having us as well.
Brad Kolowich, Jr., he's a certified personal trainer and co-author of the book Fitter Faster, The Smart Way to Get in Shape in Just Minutes a Day. And also Robert Davis, journalist, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Robert Davis is co-author on that book. Again, it's entitled Fitter Faster, The Smart Way to Get in Shape in Just Minutes a Day. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.